You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 133 of the Fabio's Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. Happy Thanksgiving week.
Wow.
Happy Apple Cup week.
Oh, man. This is a big week. And I want to talk Thanksgiving, but we already did that with an expert last year.
We did. I'm going to put that interview with Nate Duncan, where we ranked our top Thanksgiving foods, at the end of this podcast. So you can enjoy that as you're driving to wherever you might go for Thanksgiving or that sort of thing.
Oh, with the kids in the car, everybody loves hearing Nate Duncan.
That's true. He's fun for all ages. Fun for all ages.
And if you haven't listened to that, this was last year around Thanksgiving. We ranked our top five favorite Thanksgiving items. I mean, I want to do it every year, but I don't think that my ranking has changed.
Yeah, it doesn't change that much. And potato takes are pretty similar.
I mean, you just can't. We on our own can't compare to Nate Duncan.
Oh, I mean, he's the master. We gotta have Nate Duncan on at some point. The Chipotle pod is long overdue.
Oh,
I would say. You know what could crack the top five Thanksgiving food rankings, though?
What was that?
The Leftovers burger from Lil Woody's, the burger of the week this week. They come hard at the end of November, first off with the mac and cheese burger, which I went and got twice.
You got it twice?
Of course I did.
Wait, we haven't talked about the mac and cheese burger. I'm telling you right now, you and Katie are a little bit too high on that mac and cheese burger.
Because I think it's the best burger in Seattle, full stop?
It's good. It's good.
It's perfect. There is no better cheese than mac and cheese.
It's not perfect.
I mean,
I could use a pickle.
Perfect.
Like, I don't. Okay.
You're free to have your opinion.
I just have.
You're just not even going to express it now?
I have a more adult palate than you have.
Oh, wow.
Is what my opinion is. Wow. I was going to say, I'm a traditionalist when it comes to burgers. But this Leftovers burger.
Yeah, it's pretty good, too.
I'm a traditionalist when it comes to burger. I like a burger patty, and I like stuffing and gravy and turkey on it. You know, just like you grew up with.
Cranberry, too, right?
Cranberries. Yeah. Do you want to go get this tomorrow?
Okay.
We should go.
Something that works for me, I guess.
So much that you should say go twice.
Yeah. Definitely want to say go repeatedly. Yeah, so that's the burger of the week this week. We endorsed that, enjoyed that last year as well. Yeah, I think it's a solid, it's probably a solid number three or four, I would say, in my burger of the week power rankings. Mac and cheeseburger at the top of the list, a little Big Mac somewhere in there, and then when they do the Peltoncast burger, I don't know.
See,
if we're counting that.
You're like, distant 14th is the Peltoncast
burger. Well, I don't know if we're counting that because it's not like an annual fixture those are. I mean, hopefully it will be, but I don't know that we can claim that it is yet. It's only occurred one time.
You're self-hating when it comes to burgers.
Maybe I am. Should we open up this week's beer? Because we have a couple toasts to get to.
All right.
We are drinking the Fremont Mod Pod IPA. We didn't previously have this on the podcast, did we?
No,
did we?
I've never had it before.
Okay, I've had this at some point. Let's see. This is the Mod Pod IPA honors our three pods of southern resident orca whales living full time in the Puget Sound. I swear I've read this.
We might have actually had this before.
I'm pretty sure I've read this.
You know, reading about those pods of whales, the J, the K, and the L pods.
I mean, it's a great thing to honor. I don't mind doing it in a second. To let the listener in behind the scenes. The reason we're drinking this one is because of the fact that the beer that I brought over, I put it in my backpack to take it over to your house. And as I was getting out of my car, it fell out of the backpack and spilled on the sidewalk and cracked open.
Shattered glass on the sidewalk in front of my house. And you were too scared to clean it up because you read on the Nextdoor app that there was police activity in the area.
It was not just that there was police activity. There was a lot more going on than that. We don't need to get into the whole details of that, but yes,
people are going to be reporting that there's broken glass in front of my house tomorrow.
They probably are. They're going to be very upset about that on the next day. I'm almost as mad as they are about people lighting off fireworks.
We should just start lighting off fireworks
that
to celebrate the Peltoncast.
What this podcast is about.
Like we light off fireworks like the Mariners do when there's a home run. Whenever there's a really good Mariners hot take, then we light off fireworks.
It's our version of a ding.
fireworks. We pause, go outside and light off some fireworks.
You know what the weird thing is? Somehow Zach Harper doesn't get enough fireworks either. Okay, we have a couple of toasts to deliver this week. First off,
beer's still good, whether we've had it or not.
No, of course, undoubtedly. A toast to Sue Bird, the Storm's veteran point guard, all-star point guard, is joined the Denver Nuggets as a basketball operations associate during her WNBA offseason. She'll continue to play for the Storm, of course. No, you know, no imminent retirement in sight for Sue.
That's
third Pelton brother Sue Bird. I had a chance to talk to Sue after this got announced and wrote up a news story on ESPN.com. So everyone should go check that out if you haven't already.
Okay.
Congrats.
Toast to Sue.
Yeah. And also, as I mentioned on Twitter, deepening the Seattle ties with the Denver Nuggets. I mean, Isaiah Thomas, obviously, excited to see him back on the court at some point. And then also Michael Porter, if you count him as a Seattleite.
Of course we do.
Yeah. We're going to take credit for his accomplishments.
Yeah. I'll claim anybody.
Yeah. That's fair.
All right. And I don't think this will be the last we'll be discussing Sue Bird
in 2018.
In calendar year 2018.
I would hope not. Also, while we're here, a toast to Adrian Beltre as the former Mariner announced his retirement after 21 major league seasons at age 39. Adrian Beltre was like 16 when he debuted. It was like, actually, he was like too young to sign with the Dodgers. It was a big thing. But spent five, I would say, frustrating years with the Mariners because of the fact that he was like so completely ill-equipped to play in Safeco Field. But then he got to other stadiums and it turned out that Adrian Beltre was really good at baseball. And he is, I think, a pretty certain Hall of Famer after his retirement.
Yep. We will always know Adrian Beltre as one of the Mariners star players during a period when I probably watched maybe one Mariners game in a matter of 5 years.
I was going to say during a period where they weren't very good, but that's the whole period.
that's just the team.
They made the whole history out of not being very good. And we'll get to more on that. Actually, I guess I don't know that we have anything else right here. I think it's time for, again, an off-season edition of your favorite segment.
Wow, getting right into it.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at you.
Well, the Mariners went ahead and did it. They traded away the big turkey, and all they got in return was a green bean casserole, some canned corn, and a cranberry sauce to be named later. And really, that's just what this Mariners team... No, this Mariners franchise is. They're an empty turkey carcass. Their front office has no giblets, and their roster has no stuffing.
Wow.
You know who the feckless chef is of this meal? It's Trader Jerry.
Feckless?
Who last winter promised us all we needed was some mac and cheese and biscuits to complete this meal, but it wasn't all gravy. And now we're in a situation where we're losing all the potatoes and we'll only be left with au gratin.
First off, I ride for au gratin. I had au gratin the other day. It was great.
But you know me. I don't like to speak ill on a holiday.
No.
So I'll take a cue from Chris Collinsworth and give this trade a rating of Happy Thanksgiving.
Well done, sir. One of our all-time favorite moments. Chris Collinsworth repeatedly saying Happy Thanksgiving to express his dismay during a Thanksgiving broadcast. This, of course, referencing the big turkey in this, formerly known as the Big Maple, James Paxton, who was
seasonally known as the Big Turkey.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, here's the thing is we often do holiday-themed hot takes. Never did we imagine we were going to get to do Thanksgiving ones because it's usually not part of the baseball calendar. But here we go. Traded to the Yankees.
People are just lucky I just didn't sing a national anthem.
I mean, that was an all-time Mariners hot take and an all-time James Paxton moment. It had to be the Yankees, didn't it? Like, it just had to.
Oh, yeah. He was getting traded to the Yankees. The moment they announced they were going to trade James Paxton, they should have just traded him to the Yankees that day.
Unclear whether at that point they would have gotten a better return. So I don't know which of these is the green bean casserole, which of these are the can of corn, and which of these is the cranberries, which some people like. Justice Sheffield is...
I think he's the cranberries.
Yeah, exactly. Some people like. He's kind of the marquee of this deal. Rated top 40 prospect in multiple rankings and pretty much major league ready. Made three mop-up appearances for the Yankees last year after rosters expanded. And I think you'd expect him to be part of the Mariners starting rotation in 2019. He went to the Yankees as a key part of their 2016 trade, sending Andrew Miller to the Indians. There is some belief, though, despite that lofty prospect ranking, that his poor control might make him a better fit as a reliever rather than a starter. Mariners also got another starting pitcher, Eric Swanson, who's performed similarly to Sheffield in the high minors, but he's got a more limited ceiling at age 25. And then an outfielder who's probably more in the throw-in variety and kind of a lottery ticket as a prospect. So really about these two pitchers the Mariners have gotten in return. And it's good because nothing's more reliable than pitching prospects.
So Justice Sheffield, when he tweeted, thank you, next, after it was announced that he was traded, and he's played for the Yankees, the Red Sox, and the Mariners, and we know which one of those teams is going to teach him pain.
Yeah, that's safe to say. We shouldn't let this trade overshadow the fact that the fallout continues from last week's accusations of racism and sexism against the Mariners front office. The Athletic's Ken Rosenthal obtained an email from Mariners chairman and CEO John Stanton sent to team employees last Friday. The key quotes from that email: "We worked for months with Dr. Martin," who was the one who made these allegations, "to try to reserve concerns about her job performance and her workplace behavior. Dr. Martin never made allegations against our executives during these conversations. Unfortunately, our efforts were not successful, and on October 10th, she was relieved of all her duty. She was relieved of her duties." I don't know if that's how I copied it. That's how it was on the article. A week later, Dr. Martin made allegations of racism and sexism were raised for the first time. Again, the editing here, not strong. "We took these allegations seriously, and our human resources and legal departments did a thorough internal review, which found there was no basis for the claims. Major League Baseball has now launched its own investigation, which we fully support. We are confident the outside review will reach the same conclusion." I also thought this was notable. "We have worked hard over the years to ensure that the Mariners treat every employee fairly and with respect and dignity," which I feel like that landed poorly after the not accusations, but admitted sexual harassment reported by the Seattle Times this summer that occurred years earlier.
They're just pretending that didn't happen.
Yeah. Martin told Rosenthal that she has been advised to stop talking to the media, but, quote, "when ready, I will show proof." T.J. Cotterill of the News Tribune also advanced the story by speaking to the two Dominican trainers whose contracts were not renewed this year shortly after Martin was fired. Leonardo Santiago, who was with the organization for 10 years, said that DePoto and Andy McKay, the director of player development, who was also part of these accusations, treated him differently than the Mariners' American employees. His quote through a translator on the, or through an interpreter on the phone: "It seemed like DePoto and McKay would talk to just about everyone who was of American descent and talk to them more personally and try to be involved with them, but never with me." So we'll see what more this MLB investigation yields. I mean, I do think one key takeaway from that John Stanton email, Dr. Martin had said that she had taken these concerns to Mariners HR, and it was unclear at that point whether that had occurred during the season or after she was fired. And according to Stan's email, it did occur after she was fired. So there wouldn't necessarily be the same kind of paper trail ahead of time that, you know, I think the people who were expecting this to really stick to the Mariners front office might have been hoping. Yeah. All right. Other Mariners off the field news as they stay busy. Forbes' Maury Brown reports that T-Mobile has won the naming rights to Safeco Field, after Safeco's naming rights deal expired this year. The Safeco Field name has been taken off the stadium already. That deal can't be finalized until the M's first complete a new lease agreement, so neither T-Mobile nor the Mariners.
It's on one part of the field. It's on, like, the side. It's just not on the back.
Okay, so it only got removed from a certain part?
Yes.
All right, but obviously it is not going to continue to be named Safeco Field, and it seems near certain that it will, in fact, be named after T-Mobile.
Well, and, you know, we've learned from this Mariners organization that it's definitely not a safe space.
Wow. That landed. To transition us, the Sounders also apparently will have new kit sponsorship next season.
Really?
Yeah.
Taco Time, where are you?
Well, you should check out. We retweeted from the Talkin' Taco Time account a mock-up by Twitter user Lick It P that put the Taco Time logo right there on the Sounders uniforms, and it looks terrific, I gotta say.
It looks majestic.
Yeah. I think it would be a good choice. I don't think sadly that it will probably have to happen. Also, his tweet about this is his caption of this: free Mexi fries after every game. I'm sold.
There we go.
Yeah.
Looks but we don't want just free Mexi fries with some sort of thing happening. We want Taco Time on the kits. Sounders make it happen. Not Taco Time make it happen. Sounders go out and make it happen.
Good call. They will not have Xbox, which has been on the jerseys throughout franchise history. But as far as who's going to be wearing those jerseys, news on that front this week as well. The Sounders exercised options on 10 players, including Kim Keehee, Chad Marshall, Alex and Christian Roldan, Harry Shipp and Gustav Svensson. They already had 12 key players under contract for 2019, so pretty much everyone will be back with a couple of notable exceptions. One of those, Lamar Nagel, the longtime, many-time Sounder, had his option declined after not playing much this season. And then most notably, Osvaldo Alonso is now out of contract and will become a free agent. Alonso,
I didn't even realize Lamar Nagel was still on the team.
Yeah, he didn't play a lot last season. Alonso made $1.14 million last year, and now because of the fact that the Sounders were unwilling to offer him more than the MLS maximum, which could have prevented him from being a free agent, teams are limited to offering him the MLS maximum roster charge of approximately $500,000 next season. So if he plays in the MLS, he's going to have to take a pretty dramatic pay cut, which, you know, is probably consistent. He performed well last season, but the injuries he's had in recent years, his age, not surprising that he would take a pay cut. But the question now is whether that will, you know, whether there will be enough interest elsewhere in the MLS that Alonso finds a new home, or whether he comes back to the Sounders at a reduced price. It's tough to imagine the Sounders without Osvaldo Alonso. He's been here since the beginning.
Just the MLS salary stuff is so ridiculous.
This particular role is exceptionally bizarre, and it's like it affects like a half dozen players in the league.
So because the Sounders weren't willing to offer him more than the maximum.
Now they spun it as like if they had, so even if they offered him $1 more than the maximum, then he can't become a free agent.
What is the maximum?
Approximately $500,000.
So they could have offered him $500,000 and $1.
I mean, it's a little bit more than $500,000, but that amount and $1.
And
like,
they didn't.
It's like $500,700.
Why didn't they offer him that?
I mean, they don't think he's worth it. That's the answer.
But is it that much money?
If
Osvaldo Alonso were a basketball player, he'd be making $10 million plus.
Well, the MLS salary structure is not the same as basketball. I mean, the one thing is, even though he was making more money, it was only counting against the cap, I'm assuming, the maximum roster charge, and the difference was being paid with targeted allocation money, and I don't think the Sounders want to pay that down anymore, and they just may not think he's worth this. I mean, I think this is all connected. Something we talked about last week is that Christian Roldan probably is going to move back to defensive midfield on a more regular basis next season, and that was maybe going to push Alonso to the bench.
Speaking on behalf of Osvaldo Alonso, which I feel comfortable to do.
Oh, yeah.
The disrespect is well noted.
Oh, wow. I got to say, yeah, I'm disappointed by it because, there has been trade rumors many times in the past, but this was when Alonso was coming off poor injury plague season.
Go sign with FC Dallas, Ozzy.
He's coming off a good year here where he was a key starter for the Sounders throughout the second half of the season. So, I mean, from a depth perspective, I'll be a lot happier if Alonso is on the roster next year. All right, but here's the real Sounders news story.
I really can't believe this news.
Already been discussed on Twitter, as many people have replied to @PeltonCast with this. Mickey Turner of The Athletic reports that the MLS is planning changes to the season and playoff structure. They could be implemented at the MLS Board of Governors meetings in December. Under the proposal, the regular season would end the first weekend of October, with shortened playoffs, likely just a single match now instead of the two-match aggregate format that the MLS currently uses for the semifinals and conference finals, wrapping up ahead of the November international break.
How do you even have a season if it doesn't go into late December?
I mean, how can you have a playoffs if there isn't a random two-week break in the middle so that the U.S. team can go out and lose to Italy?
Did they lose?
Yeah. Oh. Italy scored in the...
A toast. Did Lasagna get the goal?
No, it was not Lasagna. Oh,
you know, I heard he moves in silence.
Wow. Only the G moves in silence.
What was the score?
1-0. They scored in the very last minute of stoppage
time.
Such
an Italian victory.
Classic Italian victory.
Who scored?
I do not remember. Not someone notable. They also had 16 shots, I believe, and 7 on goal before finally converting
what
that
is
one.
The...
It was a very Italian problem.
Well, anyway, toast to Kevin Lasagna.
All right, so
it's Kevin, right?
Yes, it sure is. Like I said on Twitter, I didn't know I had an Italian
story
name.
For ESPN.com about the greatest Kevins in soccer or something.
Oh, that is a great idea. I'm glad you proposed that. If the regular season ends in early October and MLS keeps its opening weekend in early March, this would mean... Oh, I'm sorry. This was my favorite quote from the story, the two paragraphs from the story. I forgot that I was quoting here. All right. If the regular season ends in early October and MLS keeps its opening weekend in early March, this would mean that players on teams that don't make the playoffs would have nearly 5 months between competitive games. Their bingo card, apparently, MLS offseason is too long.
5 months is too long?
The issue will be an even longer offseason for teams, and that presents a problem for player development and too much time off. Said a source with knowledge of this discussion.
Who is against this?
I don't. I mean, there are some concerns. It's going to mean more midweek games, more frequent games. So that's a bit of an issue for players, I think. But to some extent, for selling tickets, but better for TV to have those midweek games, and then also I think better to have the most important games of the season not being played in frigid temperatures in December, typically in Toronto, as far as I can tell.
I mean, really, like, look, I'm just an unfrozen caveman lawyer, but the season should end the day that the NFL starts. The last match, and the last match that happens for soccer should be that last weekend of the NFL preseason.
I mean, that would require you to play in January. You would have to start the season.
Or you play less games.
I don't think that's a realistic idea at this point.
Think about it.
Yeah, that's not a consideration. But definitely very amusing, the idea. Like, that's like if you're eliminated from the NBA playoffs, your season ends in April, and you don't play a competitive game again under this rubric that apparently preseason matches don't count until, you know, mid-October.
What?
You go 6 months.
They even know, remember how to play soccer.
I know.
Oh, my gosh. Well, we're going to have to monitor the situation closely. Really, the MLS season is still going to be very long.
It is. Look, we don't actually need to retire that bingo square, Ben Bear. we're still going to hit that. It's not quite, it won't be quite as long, but it'll still be longer than the MLB regular season, I think. All right, we turn our attention to Husky men's basketball, who have started off their three games in the Vancouver Showcase in Vancouver, British Columbia, with a pair of victories, beating Santa Clara 82-68 on Sunday, and then just moments before we recorded this podcast, holding off Texas A&M in a game they trailed big early to win 71-67.
And exceeded 67. Their KenPom projection for this game.
They did barely
somehow.
Exceed that. Yes, despite shooting 23.8% in the first half they trailed by double digits much of the way. But a big effort from Noah Dickerson, who had 24 points and 17 rebounds in this one. And the Huskies were able to get enough stops to win while still only shooting for the game 33%.
This offense is brutal.
It's not been great. Jalen Noel really came through and saved the offense in the Santa Clara game, tying his career high with 32 points on 11 of 15 shooting, including 4 3-pointers. And one of the factors here, and probably not a foremost factor because he ended up playing 30 minutes, but Noel spent a lot of this game in foul trouble with 4 fouls. Dickerson had early foul trouble, although he only finished with 2. And then Matisse Thybulle with some foul trouble late in the game. He missed some important minutes, but still came up with probably the single most crucial play of this game. Huskies turned it over, I think leading by 3 at that point, maybe 4. Texas A&M fast break seems destined to end in a layup.
He tipped the ball even before they were able to start the fast break to slow it down.
Yeah, because it was a turnover throwing to him. And Thybulle blocks the ball off of the shooter out of bounds, giving the ball back to the Huskies. An amazing athletic play.
Matisse Thybulle is like... If you were to draw like a cartoon version of Matisse Thybulle, he's no torso. He is all arms.
That is accurate.
His arms are everywhere. It's amazing to see. Look, no offensive ability whatsoever.
Oh, that's harsh.
mild offensibility whatsoever. But Matisse Thybulle on defense is amazing.
All right, another notable thing to come out of this game, Hamir Wright ended up playing 36 minutes and starting the second half. It seems like he is inevitably going to overtake Sam Timmons as the starter who played just 5 minutes in this one, any game now. Not a great offensive game for Hamir Wright, who shot 1 of 8 from the field.
They may continue to just start. I mean, it was like, you know.
But why?
I don't know. Didn't the Sonics start Irvin Johnson for a lot of games and barely play him before Big Smooth came in?
Yeah, but eventually at some point during the playoffs, they gave up that charade and just started Sam Perkins.
It's pronounced charade.
Hamir Wright in this one with 4 blocks, 3 assists, 8 rebounds, and 2 steals. Really
I like what Hamir Wright's doing.
He's been outstanding so far this year. The sophomore class, as we talked about last week, has been great. The Huskies, because of their loss to Auburn, even though they're now 4-1, fell out of the top 25 after the opening poll. The other topic to get to before we talk about the upcoming games, Huskies signed 2 recruits on the early December signing day, or November signing day. Marysville Pilchuck forward Raekwon Battle and Portland guard Marcus Sahonis. Sahonis goes to the same high school at Jefferson as Terrence Ross once went to. And both of those players played together for the Seattle Rotary AAU team. So,
are these players, do they have star ratings? Do we care?
Generally 3-star recruits, I would say.
Okay.
So the Huskies will finish up their time in Vancouver on Wednesday by hosting Minnesota in what's essentially the de facto championship game, even though there wasn't actually a tournament format to this this pairing of 4 teams.
I thought they were in Victoria for these games. I swear you said that.
No.
Okay.
I did not say that. They're in the Vancouver Convention Center.
It would have been lovely if they were in Victoria.
I mean, it's lovely either way. The shots looked great.
Yeah, no, Vancouver looks great.
It's a beautiful city. Kind of a little bit of a rich man's Seattle, for being honest.
Wow.
I know. This should be a great matchup, though. Both of these teams, again, 2-0 so far in this tournament. Both of them narrowly held off Texas A&M, pretty comfortably beat Santa Clara. They are ranked almost identically in KenPom. 45th for Minnesota, which is 4-0, 48th for Washington. KenPom rates it a perfect toss-up, 50-50,
wow.
Giving the Minnesota the ever-so-slight 75-74 edge because someone has to be favored in terms of the scoreline. So this will be one that I think really could carry some weight in terms of seeding and that sort of thing down the road.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, Minnesota is not going to be the most impressive victory. And honestly, this win over Texas A&M, winning against a team from the SEC is very nice.
But they are on a 4-game losing streak.
Against good teams. Beating a team from the Big Ten would be huge.
Good teams and UC Irvine at home.
Most importantly, though, is that when it comes to NCAA tournament time, there could be a decision that's made between UW and Minnesota for an at-large bid.
That is possible.
And this game could decide that bid, where they're looking at it and they're saying, which of these teams do we want? Oh, well, the Huskies won. Yep. Or Minnesota won. This is a very huge game, considering that it's before Thanksgiving.
Yeah, it's a big swing game because of the fact that, like, it's not a bad loss. It's like it's a bad loss if they lose it, but it just would be a boost for them if they could win it. The Huskies will then return home after the Thanksgiving holiday to host Eastern Washington next Tuesday. The Eagles come in ranked number 217 in KenPom, off to a 1-3 start, having lost a pair of games to Syracuse and Oregon on the road as part of the campus games of the 2K Classic, and then at home to Green Bay in overtime before getting their only win so far against UMKC, Missouri-Kansas City, at home in overtime. They did win 20 games last season, lost 79-69 to the Huskies in Seattle. UW women's basketball suffered a 63-51 loss Sunday at Tulane, their first of the season, and will stay out on the road this week. They are playing in the Gulf Coast Showcase in Estero, Florida, starting Friday with a matchup against Duke that will probably doom the Huskies to the loser's bracket of this one. We'll see if they can get a couple of wins down the road in this tournament that would be nice to have on a neutral site. The Seattle Seahawks, coming off a 27-24 win last Thursday night over the Green Bay Packers. If you haven't already, definitely want to check out our post-game recap.
Don't listen to it.
Look, many people were saying it was one of their favorite Felton casts.
Nobody said that.
Zach didn't seem to imply it.
Oh.
He didn't specifically say it, but he implied it.
You read through the lines of what many people were saying.
Exactly. He was saying it with his eyes.
I'm sorry, Ben. I'm sorry for everything.
How much of that podcast do you recall recording?
Don't worry about it.
Since we had that discussion, me and whoever was there with me, we won't talk a lot about that.
Although
game
I did see a tweet that said Tristan was right.
It did check out.
And really, how does it feel to be so wrong all the time? Worse at fantasy football, wrong all the time. Mm-hmm. Really doesn't even understand the sport of basketball very well.
Yeah, many people have said that too. I'm not looking forward to it. I just glanced at the bold predictions for 2018. Those aren't going to go well for me either.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you look at mine?
I did.
Mine look okay?
Mina's look good.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Hers weren't bold enough, if I recall correctly.
That is, they were reasonably bold.
Low-hanging fruit.
There's one where Mina and I went opposite each other on a bold prediction, and Mina is
shocking.
Probably going to win.
Shocking.
I'm definitely going to lose. Mina's probably going to win. So instead, let's talk about how much the Sunday's playoff or NFL results helped the Seahawks playoff odds. Like, basically every fringe NFC playoff contender other than the Cowboys, who suddenly look like they may win the NFC.
But they were playing against another fringe playoff contender. Like,
they were playing against Atlanta, true. Yeah. Everything
whomever won that game was going to be 5-5.
Everything went the Seahawks' way. Their playoff odds up to 45% per Football Outsiders, despite the fact that their rating actually dropped with a poor DVOA showing against the Packers.
So. But not a poor DVOA showing.
Well, worse than the Packers, which is not what you would expect if you were watching that game, I suppose.
We should start telling that to some people who are criticizing the Packers after the game.
Yeah.
We should bring them the DVOA evidence that it was a pretty solid DVOA game. I mean, it doesn't matter, but you know.
It doesn't, first off. Don't say that the Seahawks DVOA championships don't matter. Yeah,
those banners are hanging.
Here you go, Twitter. One of those losses that helped the Seahawks in the playoff race coming by this weekend's opponents, the Carolina Panthers, who lost 2019 at Detroit.
There is a person on a similar Panthers podcast or Charlotte podcast or whatever who is freaking out about that loss, who is so confident that the Lions are bad because the Lions are bad, and is shocked that the Panthers were able to lose this game to them.
They should be. I mean, they outgained them 6.8 yards per play to 4.8 yards per play in this and still lost because of a combination of factors that included Cam Newton throwing an interception for the only turnover of the game, Graham Gano missing a 34-yard field goal and an extra point. And then because of that, Panthers, instead of going for the tie and for probably overtime at that point with a little over a minute left, instead decide to attempt a two-point conversion to try to take the lead. I don't want to say win the game because there was so much time left. That's why I didn't like this decision at the time. I didn't come across any win probability analysis of it, but I don't think it was helpful to them because they didn't have any timeouts. Even if they had gotten the ball back somehow on an onside kick, they would have had been challenged to score. And there was so much time left that if the game Detroit was trailing, they could have still kicked a winning field goal before the end of regulation. It wasn't like it was right at the end of the game where it's either overtime or you win or you lose outright. There was still a chance that they could have converted this two-point conversion and lost the game.
Riverboat Ron assessed the situation, saw that their percentage chances of victory were better if they would have gone for two, and he had the giblets to do it.
I love giblets on this podcast. I mean, you can make a case for it in terms of the Panthers should be a pretty good team at converting two-point conversions with Cam Newton's size and Christian McCaffrey's ability out of the backfield. That didn't translate. I still think the situation, it was
not
a time to do
it. That's fine. Let the fucking Panthers podcast debate this. We don't care. They lost.
Fine.
But the most important thing is because of all these outcomes, Pro Football Outsiders, the Seahawks playoff odds rising to 45%.
I thought I said that at the start.
And I say to you, that does not matter at all.
I mean, I guess.
Because this game is so huge when it comes to playoff odds.
So the Panthers still a game ahead of the Seahawks in the standings, despite the fact that they have a weaker point differential. They've outscored their opponents by +8 as opposed to 30+30 margin for the Seahawks this season. The Panthers have benefited from playing a substantially easier schedule. They have a harder schedule going forward. But because of the fact that they have that one game lead in this game at home, they're still in the driver's seat, I would say, to be the fifth seed in the NFC. And this, but you know, if the Seahawks can win this game, move even in the standings, claim the tiebreaker, suddenly they're looking pretty good to make the playoffs.
They would have a solid chance.
Yeah. I mean, they'd probably schedule is still very difficult to end the season.
They'd probably be like well above 60 if they won.
Not very difficult because of the fact that they do have two games against the Niners and the Cardinals at home.
They have three games against the two worst teams in the NFL.
Oh, yeah. I can't wait for bold predictions time.
Wait, did we say an over for some of these teams? All of these teams? Oh, God.
We'll get to it.
Oh, no.
we'll get to it.
Oh, man.
So good. I'm going to be able to say it without laughing. yeah, so the Panthers, intriguingly, almost identical.
Their schedule gets a...
Well, they've
got a couple. Twice,
yeah, they have two games against the Saints.
But they also...
The Browns.
Play the Buccaneers.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, the last three, Saints, Falcons, Saints,
yes,
are very tough.
Yes. They're going to want to be in good shape going into those three games. The Panthers, intriguingly, almost identical in terms of their rankings in offensive DVOA to the Packers. They come in fourth in rushing and 13th in passing. Cam Newton, obviously, a major part of that. He's completing a career-high 68% of his passes. His yards per completion is a career low in this slightly more conservative Norv Turner scheme, but still his total yards per attempt is his best since his MVP season, where the Panthers went to the Super Bowl and lost. His sacks and interceptions are also down, and notably, he's fifth in completion percentage above the expected based on the passes he's throwing per NFL at Next Gen Stats using the tracking data, a category in which Russell Wilson is one spot ahead of him in fourth.
What does that mean?
So basically, it's like the distance of the throw, location of nearby defenders. It's kind of like we talk a lot in basketball about using the second spectrum tracking data, expected field goal percentage on any given shot.
Still,
and that's what they're doing with these passes.
So it's basically like how good are you at threading passes or whatever, getting into tight windows, stuff like that.
Yeah, just assessing the difficulty. So like we looked at this like with Derek Carr earlier in the year, where he has a really high completion percentage this year, but he's also throwing incredibly easy passes. So he doesn't necessarily deserve as much credit for that as someone.
Never changed Derek Carr.
Oh yeah,
we love you.
For David Carr is someone who's throwing more difficult.
Also,
passes.
Never changed David Carr.
The stats on Cam as a runner this year are kind of inscrutable. He's averaging, I think, 4.6 yards per carry, part of this number 4 ranked Carolina rushing attack, but yet somehow still has a below average rushing DVOA and is way behind Russell Wilson in DVOA as rushers. But then you go to the expected points added calculation in ESPN's QBR, and Cam is... near the top among quarterbacks in rushing value, partially because he's got so many plays as a rusher, more than any other quarterback, and Russ rates pretty mediocre as a rusher there. So I don't quite know what to make of that, but I know that I'm still scared of him rushing the ball.
Oh, yeah. I'm scared of all things at all times.
Christian McCaffrey has become a much bigger weapon in his second season. Intriguingly, his stats almost identical this year to Chris Carson's. McCaffrey has 136 carries for 632 yards. Carson has 128 carries for 580 yards. So he's 8 carries and 52 yards short of McCaffrey.
But isn't a large part of Christian McCaffrey's value in the receiving game?
First off, a large part of every running back's value is in the receiving game because that's where they can really distinguish themselves. But he is, in fact, number 3 in receiving DR among running backs and leads the Panthers in targets this season. Devin Funchess leads the team in receiving yards, but rookie DJ Moore, their first-round pick, is really coming onto the scene. He had 7 catches for 157 yards and a touchdown last week against the Lions. And yes, the Seahawks did not show any interest in drafting him. Per Pro Football Reference, he is 3rd among all players with at least 25 targets in yards per target this season.
I can't believe that. As a rookie wide receiver, that's very impressive.
That is. He's like the lingering, back when they had all sorts of deep threats, Ted Ginn. I forget who the other receiver was during the Super Bowl year who had like enormous yards per target. A bunch of long completions, but he's like the one guy left doing that because Funchess is kind of more of a possession receiver, but he had 3 drops against Detroit, so he's kind of in
you're
the
talking
doghouse.
DJ right Moore
now. Hmm?
Yes, you're talking about DJ Moore.
I'm talking about who is comparable to him during their Super Bowl.
It's still like such a weird way you said he's the one guy left. He's their deep target.
Yeah, he's the one guy left playing that style that they used to play. Everyone else is kind of running more underneath stuff. At the other end of the field, though, this is where the Seahawks should have the advantage because the Carolina defense ranks 25th in DVOA, 25th against the pass. The dominant defensive line that we remember back in these classic Panthers-Seahawks battles back in the day, and there was a fun story on The Athletic by their Panthers beat writer Joseph Person talking about kind of the similarities between these two teams and how their rivalry evolved. That defense doesn't exist this year. After having 6 sacks in their opening win at Dallas, they're averaging less than 2 per game since then. And even though they've been excellent against number one wide receivers in terms of DVOA, they've been really poor against number 2 wide receivers, and tight ends have lit them up. So maybe a revenge game for Ed Dixon coming off his game-winning touchdown last week.
We're going to pass the ball like 6 times.
It's true. They have actually been better than average in terms of rush defense. So maybe not like
better than average.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like better than the average team.
Oh, I think I might be. I was looking at the
offense. You were looking at the Seahawks rush defense.
Yeah, I'm baffled by this number.
It is strange, especially given that like Aaron Jones did nothing against them last week. But
he did not do nothing.
He didn't do that much. He did a lot as a receiver, but not really that much as a runner.
Wow, I was thinking that they were going to tee off on this 19th ranked rush defense, but that's us.
That was them in practice.
Man, okay. Yeah.
So it doesn't necessarily fit the Seahawks' strengths as well as the Green Bay defense did, where it really looked like it set up for a great game. But I still think this is a defense that they can move the ball against, especially if they do get behind and are forced to start passing more. Much to their dismay.
I mean, they haven't necessarily shown a ton of ability to be able to do that, and that makes me a little bit nervous.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not necessarily, like, against Green Bay, they were playing from behind, but they weren't playing from so far behind that they had to change their style of play.
Accurate.
And I think that they are only comfortable playing one way. Brian Schottenheimer can only call a game one way.
They haven't really shown any ability to mix it up.
I mean, we think of those kind of first 2 weeks where they passed the ball a ton, and it just didn't look right. Everything was discombobulated in those first couple weeks. And if they can't get their run game going and be able to set up the play action and get comfortable with the passes when they need to pass the ball, then it could be a long day. However, I just don't know if I really believe that this is... like they're going to stop the Seahawks run offense.
We'll see.
I think they'll be able to run the ball against Carolina, seeing them as the number 12 rushing offense. Like, the difference between 12 and 18 is not that great.
That is accurate. That is fair.
So,
but they have been playing against some really poor run defenses lately, is what I would say.
The
Seahawks have benefited from that.
So, last week, Kerryon Johnson had an excellent game against Carolina and was kind of a driving force in why Detroit won that game. And a lot of, like, some boom or bust was happening, which the Seahawks are definitely familiar with. But Kerryon Johnson having big plays against their defense is something that I wouldn't be shocked to see happen from the Seahawks' triumvirate of running backs.
Oh, you're seeing another big Rashad Penny run?
When can Jaime McKissick come back? Is that this week?
He is eligible to come back this week, based on Pete Carroll's comments. It does not sound like he's going to be back anytime soon. They're probably going to try to delay this decision as long as they can, and they don't have to make it until, I think it's a day after the Vikings game.
Oh, man.
So it's a while. They've got a couple weeks yet.
But I would not be surprised. And seeing the pass defense, you know, if they're on an island, watching, did you see the play, the first play of the game where the Seahawks were like just all over the run and then running backwards? It's kind of fun to watch defenses, like the flow of a defense when they see a play action.
It's fun to watch when the Seahawks are the ones running the play action.
Sure.
Yeah.
But I'm saying just like even just watch or, it from or, a watching football
or
perspective.
Or as a neutral, the Rams Chiefs. That was fun to watch.
I'd be curious to see what the play action looked like. But, you know, we're...
It looked pretty good for the Rams. I'm not very aware of that.
Neither of us are Brock Heward followers. Whereas, did you see that, Paul? He's like, is this the kind of football you want to see going forward? And it's like 20% of people were like, yes.
Wait, really? It was 80-20 against?
No, I think when I looked, it was like 33 or something said yes. And I'm like, who are these people who follow you? These people are Pete Carroll devotees.
Wow.
These people have drank the Kool-Aid.
I mean, there were enough people replying. And we can't read Bardwell's comments again because we don't have him on. Someday we're going to do this. But there were a lot of people complaining about his assertion that it was one of the best games or possibly the best game ever.
Literally, I literally was like, when Tyreek Hill caught that pass on the last Chiefs drive, which I'm so sad, wasn't able to continue a little bit longer. I cheered.
I had a friend who is Canadian who does not follow football at all was chatting me about this football game. That's how much of a cultural force it was.
Is Canadian football, do they score more points?
They do score more points.
Yeah, it was probably more comfortable to them. It just looked a little bit more
familiar. Don't think this person, I don't think she's a big Canadian football fan either.
Anyway, I think the Seahawks will be able to run the ball in this game and set up that play action. I hate when I say that. What I mean is run play action. Set up play action in Brian Schottenheimer's mind.
Yes.
And be very effective when doing it.
Do you have a chance of victory for this game?
50%.
That's too optimistic for me for a 10 a.m. game on the road across the country. I think on a neutral field, the Seahawks are the better team, which to me, the 3.5 line is a little bit too high.
I thought the line was too high.
I thought this was going to be a 3-point line, maybe 2.5.
Even just also, like, I don't want to say that momentum exists, but the way that the Panthers have been playing lately, vis-a-vis the way that the Seahawks have been playing lately, like, one team is trending in a different direction than the other.
Did they play poorly before that loss to the Lions?
They got beaten by like 50 points.
Oh, yeah, that one. Okay, good point. Good point.
Are you kidding me? Yes, they played poorly?
I forgot that.
They played one of the worst games I've seen by a good team.
It was on Thursday Night Football against the Steelers when they gave up, I believe, 52 points? I want to say 52?
But also on big plays.
They gave up a Rams-Chiefs-esque number of points, and they didn't score a Rams-Chiefs.
In that game, though, there were a lot of big passing plays, and it'll be interesting to see if the Seahawks are able to also employ that offense.
Yeah, which was something they didn't really get against Green Bay.
But they're able to do it. We know that they are.
It's in their arsenal.
And I like the intermediate territory, you know, that it seems like a lot of teams have been exploiting this year. But once you get to the 25 to 30,
end
zone at that point.
Yeah.
And I think against this Carolina team could mean touchdowns for the Seahawks.
I'm going to go 45% chance of victory. That might be a little higher than I actually think, but I'll round up to 45%.
It's one of those games where the stakes are so high. I don't think it's going to be quite as ugly as a lot of the previous.
There was like, what, 12-9?
They're honestly
12-10?
Pete Carroll, whatever they've done, they've managed to figure out being able to score relatively consistently. And maybe that just means that they're playing against some bad defenses, but...
No, 12-7 was the opener in 2013.
They have not had for a long time one of these classic Seahawk games where they're just like nothing is happening on either side. And it's probably because the defense is worse also.
I would say the Arizona game was that.
Well, that was the turning point. After that moment, the season changed.
Yes.
And since then, they have been able to move the ball and been able to score against pretty much whomever they're playing. And I wouldn't be shocked if it happened again against Carolina. And I honestly think the Seahawks are going to win this game.
So it's one of those optimistic 50%. Yeah, yeah, where you're going to say after the game that you called it.
Shading toward 55. It's a 55 rising.
Shading towards 80. Okay. Anything else on this game?
Happy Thanksgiving.
Let's get to our main event.
Oh, man.
That being,
it's going to be such a stressful football weekend.
The Apple Cup.
All the games matter so much.
The Pac-12 North Championship on the line between the Washington Huskies and the 8th-ranked Washington State Cougars on Friday night, 5:30 p.m. on Fox. This is a big one. This is a big one. I guess we should mention at some point here that the Huskies played a game last Saturday. It was something of a formality that they played Oregon State. I really wish they hadn't played the second half at all because it just was a slog after the Huskies got out to, I believe, a 28-3 lead in this game in the first quarter.
No, it was not.
It was 28 in the – they got to 28 early in the second quarter. I don't know. They got to 28 really quick.
They were never up 28-3.
Okay. If you say so. Trey Adams made his return in a limited role. It will be interesting to see how much he plays against the Cougs. Unclear. It's hard to tell from the stands how effective an individual offensive lineman is.
Yeah. We're down there taking notes.
Wait, which one is he? Oh, yep. The guy in the end of the line. Also on the injury front, Hunter Bryant making an impact in his second game with 2 catches for 55 yards. Coach Pete said in the lead up to this game that they're not really worried about keeping Hunter. They weren't worried about keeping Hunter Bryant to the 4 games for a redshirt season, which I think is probably the right call here.
It's not the right call. You're wrong. You're drinking the Coach Pete Kool-Aid.
What are the odds
they're
that
not
Hunter Bryant
thinking about it?
What are the odds that Hunter Bryant is going to want to come back for a 5th year?
A lot.
Are they? He's like was a legit NFL prospect before this injury.
We'll see.
And some
there
players
no
just don't
reason
even
not to protect it.
Some players, I mean, there's no.
Would they have? Would Hunter Bryant playing in this Oregon State game have affected the outcome of the game?
Would Hunter Bryant playing in this Oregon State game have helped his timing for the Washington State game?
Oh my God, his timing for the Washington State game, running around wide open.
They also
the
may not play in the Pac-12 championship game. I don't know if you're aware of this. They're not the favorites this weekend. I guess you might not be aware of that.
It's just, there's no reason not to.
If he's healthy, he should play.
It's a risk for no reason.
Anything
it
else?
It shows a lack of ability to plan on Coach Pete's behalf. Whatever. He's had it over and over and over again.
I don't think we can lump this into this. And first off, this is a case where Coach Pete may know a lot more than us because he can talk to Hunter Bryant about his plans. Some people don't even want to come back.
Nobody knows what their plans are 2 years from now. You can talk about what your plans are all you want, but there's so many known unknowns before then.
Fine.
Anyway, can we just talk about how bad the Husky special teams is?
I mean, they did force 2 fumbles on special teams on kickoffs this week.
Well, I guess good for them.
Yeah.
Slow clap for the Husky special teams that they forced 2 fumbles.
I got to find the name of the player who forced both of them.
And it is crazy to me that you have a team that is coached by Chris Peterson, who cares so much about the small details, that is so bad on special teams in basically every single way, aside from getting forced fumbles or luck. Don't give me special teams force these fumbles. They got lucky.
It's the same guy on both of them, though.
Great.
And it's a freshman walk-on seeing his first action. Edifuan Ulofosio from Anchorage, Alaska.
All right, shouts to him.
Yeah, kudos to him.
But why is this UW special teams not good? What are they doing wrong?
I don't know.
And why can't they figure it out?
I don't know.
It's going to affect them in this Wazoo game. Anyway, speaking of that.
Yeah, because if anyone's known for great special teams, it's the Washington State Cougars.
This is a place where they can be better.
Okay. So, in years past, when we have previewed the Apple Cup and been extremely confident about the Huskies' mm-hmm. chances,
mm-hmm. Yes,
it's because we've looked at the numbers, we've crunched the numbers, and said, the Cougars may score a lot of points. They may put up a lot of yards. They're not actually good on offense. That is not the case this year. They come into this game after an offensive explosion, 66 points? 69 points.
Nice.
Against Arizona, ranked 4th in ESPN's Football Power Index efficiency ratings in offense in the nation. 59th this year on defense. Their defense definitely has missed Alex Grinch and some of the players they lost from last season, and 76th on special teams. So here's the interesting thing in the context of that. That is still paradoxical about the Cougars' offense. The Huskies are averaging more yards per pass than the Cougars. A whole, by a full 1.2 yards per pass, 8.6 yards per pass to 7.4 by Shake Browning. And they are also averaging more yards per run than the Cougars, 4.4 yards per run to 3.9 yards per run. So how can the Cougars have the better offense, the fourth best offense in the country? The answer to that, my friend, is Simpson's paradox, which is a fun statistical thing where you can be better in both different splits, but still not as good at overall because of the ratio of the two things. So the reason, of course, is that all teams average way more yards per pass than they do yards per run. The Cougars are passing on 71% of their plays, the most in FBS. The Huskies are passing on 41% of their plays, which ranks 97th out of 130 teams.
We're going to have to Pete Carroll this game.
So because of that, the Cougs are averaging 6.4 yards per play to the Huskies' 6.1. And then there's probably also some elements where the short passing attack that Mike Leach and the air raid offense employs, like it's a more consistent, even though you're not necessarily picking
really
up as many yards.
Is it an air raid offense, or is it more like a West Coast offense that they're running?
It's different than West Coast. I mean, they share some philosophical commonality in terms of your interest in high completion percentage, you know, relatively safe passes. But, you know, the four wide receiver base, that sort of thing, is not really a West Coast offense kind of thing. Gardner Minshew has come in, and he's been certainly an upgrade for the Cougs at quarterback. Although his numbers aren't really dramatically different, I would say, from like some of the late era Connor Halliday numbers in terms of yards per pass.
God, that's such a burn to the Cougs.
Is it?
No, I mean, Gardner Minshew's basically like late era Connor Halliday. I mean, you know, if you like that sort of thing.
Those offenses were good. I mean, I don't
look, he's better than Luke Falk, so I guess that's cool.
I mean, they weren't giving the Connor Halliday talking about him for a Heisman, but you know. Minshew throwing interceptions on just 1.2% of his passes this year. Last year, the Cougars' passes, 2.8% of them were intercepted, and Jake Browning's interception rate so far this season is also 2.8%. Jake Haner's interception rate is higher than that.
100%, as far as I recall.
It's not 100%.
100% pick six.
Through no fault of his own, he went 1 of 2 for negative yardage last week.
Jake did.
Relief appearance.
They're all Jake, but Jake Haner did.
He did. It was a failed screen pass. Not his fault. But the other notable difference between the offense and the offense this season, Minshew has been sacked just 7 times all season, 1.2% of dropbacks. Last year, it was 5.6% of dropbacks the Cougars quarterbacks were sacked, and it has never been below 3.8% in the Leach era, when he has been known to expose his quarterbacks to a high degree of I was going to say pain. I guess that probably is accurate.
So they've Mike Leach has somehow figured out the formula to pass all the time and not get sacked.
Never have any negative plays. Very few interceptions. Very few sacks. So they're just they're matriculating the ball down the field.
Is this an offensive line thing, or is this a Gardner Minshew thing?
I don't know the Cougs well enough to know this, and you would probably not, even if you watch them every game, you would probably still want some film breakdown. We do know, based on Football Outsiders research, that like quarterbacks play a larger role in sack rate than, you know, is generally like the conventional wisdom would say. So I think Minshew certainly deserves some credit for it.
But in a lot of ways, this is the perfect offense.
Yeah. They just move the ball all the time, and they score a bunch of points. And that's good, yeah.
Is there any element to... Does this feel a little bit... And granted, does this feel a little bit like Seahawks-Rams to you?
I can see that comparison.
I mean, the Huskies like to run the ball. And are good at running the ball. And they're
only okay at running the ball. Which so are the Seahawks, frankly.
But they do it a lot.
They sure do love it.
And when they pass, they're good at passing. But yes. They don't do it a ton.
Yes.
This kind of has the elements to me of a game that's going to come down to... I think Chris Peterson's going to coach Pete this game.
Is that a positive?
Sorry. I think Coach Pete is going to Pete Carroll this game.
Okay. Again, is that a positive or a negative?
they just can't, they can't change their offense in 1 week. You know, like, if you ask me what is the ideal way to win this game, it's having a pretty good defense and having an offense that's just as good as Wazoo's. But that can't happen. They're not going to pass the ball all of a sudden. They're not going to go from passing on 41% of the plays to passing on 72% of the plays. You're just not going to do that. They're going to have to control the ball. They're going to have to keep Gardner Minshew off the field. They're going to have to hope for a turnover or two.
Yeah.
That's what this game looks like.
Okay. I think to get more on this, on the Cougs in this game, we're going to bring in a third Belden brother.
Having previewed the game, we now welcome in our Cougar correspondent for the first time that we've ever had. We've had a Coug on the pod, actually, a Thanksgiving Day pod way back in the day. But the first time we've had as a correspondent, our cousin, currently a student at Washington State University, Kyle Moffitt. Thanks for joining us on the pod.
Thank you for having me.
Kyle, the reason that you're on the podcast today is because we're in a fantasy league together. This is not the Peltoncast Fantasy League. And you texted me. We were playing each other this week. You texted me a proposition for a bet for who won this fantasy matchup.
Yes, yes.
I noticed that you waited to text me about it until after my kicker, Mason Crosby, had a pretty bad game also.
Yeah, I thought, you know, I could use that to my advantage, but, you know, Mahomes and Hill just had too good of a game.
Kareem Hunt. But
not the first time a Cougar has been too confident against the Huskies in the month of November.
I might have lost in fantasy, but the WSU Cougars will come out victorious, no doubt.
Well, save it for the end. We're going to get your percentage chance of victory here. I'm sure it'll be measured. but the bet was that if I beat you in fantasy, you would come on the Peltoncast.
Yes.
You're actually the first ever person who's wanted to come on the Peltoncast.
People desperately try to avoid this.
And if I beat you, you're going to the Apple Cup on Friday in Pullman. And if I beat you...
In the student section, right?
Yes, of course, in the student section.
You would wear a Husky shirt to the game.
Yes.
And can you show us here? We're doing a video Skype. Can you show us the Husky shirt you're going to be wearing to the game?
So I actually have two shirts. And the first shirt... It's kind of a retro.
Okay, I like that one.
Yeah, okay. Good. So, you know, it's the classic W with the Husky, you know. Now, shirt number two is a little different. It's right here.
Oh, wow, I like that. You actually have pretty nice Husky clothing.
Well, before, you know, I had gone to WSU, I was a Husky fan.
I'm willing to admit it here.
Yes, I'm willing to admit it, but the tables have turned. So, you know, we have to... I say we should have a vote.
You're going to wear the shirt.
I'm going to wear the shirt. I'm going to be a man of my word and live up to...
Are they going to be visible? Because it's going to be cold there, right? And those are both t-shirts?
Yes, they will be visible. And there will be evidence of me wearing it. And,
there we go.
You know, hopefully I will come out without any black eyes.
Oh, no. I mean, I don't want to put you at risk here. Like, consider your own safety. I got to say, they were showing the Cougar shirtless Cougar fans throughout the second half of last Saturday's game. I was half expecting to see Kyle in that group.
You know, by that time, I was already home in a warm apartment watching the game because it was a solid 22 degrees. And
it was, you know, the number of degrees it was outside was smaller than the Cougars' lead at halftime.
Yes, yeah. So I say we should either vote on which shirt, or I can take a picture and you guys can throw it out to the social media and have them choose.
Okay.
So, because this is a very big decision.
Okay.
So...
I think we should put it to Twitter vote.
I think that's the right choice.
Between the two shirts?
Yes.
Well, I hope that this taught you your lesson never to bet with somebody whose nickname is the Fantasy Genius.
Well, you know, I came in feeling really good this week and just let me down.
Well, so aside from that, we're kind of curious as our Coug correspondent.
Coug correspondent?
What the culture is like and has been like these last couple weeks on campus around the Wazoo football team.
Okay. Two words. Stash mania.
That checks out. Have you worn at any point the stash?
You know,
a stash?
I had the chance last week and I let a girl wear the stash instead because, you know, I thought it was more important to the female to understand what wearing a stash is like and the magic behind the stash.
Yeah, because you have so much experience growing mustaches.
Yes.
Can you grow a mustache?
I actually can.
All right.
And maybe by Christmas time there will be one hanging around, you know. But mustache magic is craziness. That is all I have to say. You know, we never thought that Gardner Minshew would do anything this year. And no. He has just made it to where the culture is crazy due to College Game Day coming up. We never thought that would happen, and it's happened. Also because of the old Crimson flag, but that's a whole totally different subject. But Gardner Minshew's turned this team around.
I mean, old Crimson, like, that had been a tradition for many years.
Yes.
Game Day still would not come to campus until Gardner Minshew showed up. The correlation is 100%.
Yes. But I have some stats for you guys, which is very, very interesting and shows the magic behind the stash.
Okay.
Gardner Minshew, in the national rankings, he's number one in passing yards per game, number one in passing yards, number one in total offense, number one in completions per game, number one in passing touchdowns, number four in points responsible for, and number five for completion percent in the nation.
What about yards per attempt? Did you look that one up? Because we talked about that one earlier.
You know, I could not find that stat.
But the stat that
I did find, which was interesting, was we've had 13 straight home wins.
Interesting. Who was the last loss to?
I could not find that for some reason. But
I'm doing some math here in my head. And I think it was about 13 games ago was the last time the Huskies played in Pullman, give or take.
Where does Gardner Minshew rank also in all-time quarterback wins in the Pac-12 history?
You know, that's a good question. Do you have that one? I don't have that one right here.
He's probably behind Keith Price.
Yeah.
He's definitely behind Keith Price.
He's
probably
in Carl Bunnell territory.
No, he got more than Carl Bunnell.
But so, bringing that up, we also have, you know, Mike Leach.
You sure do.
And the sad thing is, how long has he been coach? For 5-6 years, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Let's see. This is his seventh season at Wazoo.
Okay. The Wazoo Cougars football has not won an Apple Cup since 2012.
That checks out.
So, in a way, we're also the underdog. Even though we have home field advantage, we are the underdog due to losing so many Apple Cups in a row.
I don't agree with that, but it's reasonable.
Why don't you agree with it?
Because
the definition of an underdog.
That's a good point.
The point spread.
The point spread is 3 points.
Favoring Wazoo.
Which
close.
I feel is not correct. I say maybe 4.5.
You think it should have been Wazoo by 4.5?
Correct. 4.5, 5, yes. Not 3.
Clearly, I agree with you.
Yeah, so did Tristan. Okay, so what does that translate into into a percentage chance of the Cougars winning this game?
My love and soul. And just, I believe the chances of the Cougars winning is 72%.
72%? That's delightfully non-round. Very few people go non-round on this one.
72%.
Kyle, does the year 2002 mean anything to you?
You know, too young for that.
Obviously you are.
He was five at that point.
Because the spirit of 2002 is alive in this year of 2018.
Is yes. It? Well, I believe that was when we went to the Rose Bowl.
That is accurate.
So the chances of us going to the Rose Bowl, I believe, could be very, very well. Now,
I guess, yeah, you are hoping for it. But I think what Tristan is thinking of is the fact that the dreams of playing for the national championship.
There's still – so you're telling me there's a chance range.
Yes.
2.7% for Wazoo.
Yes. The one-loss record, all of those things spoiled in the Apple Cup in double overtime, I believe, by this box score does not have how many overtimes.
The only difference is that Jason Gesser didn't have a mustache for that game.
Did Matt Kegel have a mustache, though? Unclear.
Okay, so it's the top four in the playoffs. So number one is Bama, right? They're definitely going to make it. Number two is Clemson. Number three is Notre Dame. And number four is Michigan.
Uh-huh.
We're number seven. Or 7-8, depending on what you're looking at, which poll.
But the real should be looking at the college football playoff.
The real problem for the Cougs is that, like, in all likelihood, I guess the scenario that they're rooting for, besides for USC upsetting Notre Dame, is Ohio State beating Michigan and then losing the Big Ten championship game. Because otherwise, if Ohio State beats Michigan and wins the Big Ten championship game, then Ohio State's going to come from number 10 and jump over the Cougs.
What about Oklahoma? Oklahoma could lose to West Virginia.
Sure. But Oklahoma wasn't in that top four, was it? It's Alabama, Clemson.
There are teams ahead of Wazoo. They're not at number five.
Yes, that's also true. I'm just saying that even like in the best case scenario, it's probably not going to happen.
You're not going to the playoff because you're not going to win this game on Saturday or Friday. And I am willing to say, despite the point spread, I think there is a better than 50% chance of the Huskies winning this game. I'm going 55%.
Wow, this is an unusual situation.
Who are your three players that you think are going to give Wazoo a hard time? Because I have three players that I believe UW will have a very difficult time with. Who are your three players?
How many of those players are Gardner Minshew?
Actually,
and his mustache.
But I could also leave him out of the group.
My three players are Jake Browning, Miles Gaskin, and Savon Ahmed, because the Huskies are going to run all over this Wazoo team.
Okay. My three players, Aesop Winston Jr., wide receiver, yes, people
sure.
Know who he is, okay? Number two is Jihad Woods, of course. And, you know, I could say, you know, Gardner Minshew, but I'm going to throw in a crazy one and say Max Borgie.
He had a nice game on Saturday.
Future, yeah. That's future Patriot Max Borgie to you.
Arizona defense isn't walking through that door. But I got to say, it is rare that we disagree by more than 5% on our chances of victory. But this is one of those cases.
Wow.
Because I think that the right team is favored. I watch the Cougar offense. I watch the Husky defense. And I see that the Cougs excel at the very thing that these Huskies struggle with, which is just consistent completions for, you know, 6 yards, a bunch of mid-range, basically, completions. That is what the Wazoo offense has fed on all season and which haven't been available to the Cougs in the past in Apple Cups, except when they've been trailing by multiple touchdowns. And the Huskies have gone to a more conservative prevent defense at that point. But in those games, frequently, the Huskies were benefiting from a strong pass rush, getting to this weak Wazoo offensive line, getting to the quarterback time and again. And that's just not going to happen this year. The Huskies have no pass rush. The Cougars' protection is incredible. So if the Huskies are going to win this game, I think that their only chance is that they're going to have to play a bend but don't break defense, which is something that really the Cougars have avoided so far this year, somewhat rarely for them. So far this season, they are fourth in the nation in the percentage of their red zone trips that have ended in touchdowns, over 77%. Meanwhile, despite seemingly being built to play bend but don't break defense and not allowing many points, remarkably, the Huskies are 35th in points allowed per red zone trip. Now, what this means is, first off, the Huskies are going to have to get stops. And then secondly, as you say, the offense is going to have to go nuts because the Wazoo defense, 115th in points allowed per red zone trip, but the Husky offense, 102nd in touchdown percentage in the red zone. And in this case, I think the I don't know which one of these is the movable object and the stoppable force, but I don't think the Huskies are going to be able to score enough points in all likelihood to win a shootout against the Cougars. And I would say a 40% chance of UW winning this game.
That's a very acceptable prediction.
I split the difference between you two. I like being that happy medium. Any final thoughts before you head back to Pullman for this game?
My condolences to all UW fans, and watch out for James Williams. I think he'll have a big game, not on the ground, but in the air.
Okay.
But it will be a very interesting game. I think it's going to be a very cold game.
Especially for you in that Husky t-shirt.
Yes, but... You know, I believe that this is the year that Wazoo is going to come out and just kill it. And, you know, we also should ask, is Gardner Minshew ever going to be considered to be a Heisman winner? No, but he's still an incredible quarterback, and he's going to give that defense a hard time.
Well, we'll see on Friday.
Yeah.
Be safe, Kyle.
Yeah. Okay. I will. Happen. Great talking to you guys.
Stay warm. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening.
Thanks.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are joined by one of the most popular Third Pelton brothers in the history of the Peltoncast, a star podcaster in his own right. You know him from the Dunked On Basketball NBA podcast. Please welcome back to the show to share his food expertise with us once again, Nate Duncan.
Well, I wasn't popular enough that Tristan actually was able to make time to go out for burgers with me the last time I was in Seattle.
You're popular as far as a podcaster goes.
Yeah, that's right. People like me much better if they don't have to actually see me in person, I think, is what I'm learning here.
No, I severely regret not being able to do that. It was one of my biggest regrets from this last summer. But I hope that, you know, the food podcasting will extend even beyond what we're going to talk about today.
Yes, that is my hope as well.
Yeah, I mean, first off, when we start doing TJ's Today or Trader Bros or Trader Joe's podcast, obviously Nate will be a frequent guest on that podcast. But that's not what we're here to discuss today. We're here to discuss the holiday that is coming later this week, and that is Thanksgiving. And the food is a crucial part of Thanksgiving, so we wanted to count down in classic Peltoncast fashion our top five Thanksgiving foods. Something we actually did on this podcast during its very first year, way back in 2013. And it was interesting to go back, and I compared, and my list has changed. So I'm curious to see whether yours has changed, Tristan.
The takes are hotter.
Meteoric growth of the podcast has changed your taste. You're just truffled gravy and you know, caviar turkey is all you have these days.
That's interesting. Those did not crack my top five.
All of mine are much more burger related now. I literally just got finished eating a Thanksgiving burger, so I'm trying to combine everything.
Do you want to give your review here? You gave it on Twitter, but do you want to give your review of that burger here on the pod?
It was excellent. I mean, I've always wanted a burger to have gravy on it, and that finally happened for me today.
Should we talk a little about Thanksgiving in general, maybe quickly? Nate, I know when I first approached you about this, you had said you had some unorthodox Thanksgiving food takes.
Well, I guess I'm just really I'll spoil my list probably if I explain what those are. But I will say that Thanksgiving may in fact be my favorite holiday.
Yes, well,
that's good. Yeah, I mean, definitely from an eating perspective, it's the best.
Well, I would say from that standpoint, also just it's not like just deathly cold if you're in like a cold climate yet. There's some solid sports going on, and also you get 4 full days off, which is really the only holiday where you're guaranteed to get that each year.
Right. Many people do get that break between Christmas and New Year's, but not everyone. All right. So I guess let's get into it. Nate, you're the guest. So let's start off with your number 5 Thanksgiving food.
Let's see. Number 5. I guess I would have to go with, maybe it's controversial because it's not a traditional Thanksgiving food, but macaroni and cheese.
Mm.
So I don't know if that's controversial. I don't think have ever had mac and cheese at our Thanksgiving. So I couldn't put it on the list. But if we did have it, I'm sure it would be in my top 5.
I mean, mac and cheese is just a good food in general.
Sure. And it's just like it adds to the idea of Thanksgiving, which is just way more starch than you need. It's just like every single side dish is just like this massive amount of starch. Like, that's one thing that I like about Thanksgiving is like regular vegetables really are relegated to the sidelines, and it's all just like meat and starch, basically.
Pretty much, yeah. It's you're loading up for the long winter. All right, Tristan, what did you have in your number 5 spot?
So I went with number 5 as kind of the capper to my list, which would be the capper to the Thanksgiving meal. And I went with pumpkin pie at the number 5 spot.
Probably like carrot cake too, don't you?
No, don't like carrot cake, but I was saying I could see a sweet potato pie here also.
Oh, spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
And the perfect way to eat a pumpkin pie or a sweet potato pie is with vanilla bean ice cream on the side.
On the not on top?
Around it, in the general area.
I can't, like, this is just a general issue that I have with desserts, is that the idea of we're going to take something that on its own isn't a dessert and isn't sweet, and then we're going to put a crap load of sugar on it and put it into like a pie or a cake, and now we're going to call it a dessert. Like carrot cake, pumpkin pie, sweet potato pie, like all these things are not like actually dessert foods, and now you're just adding a bunch of sugar to make it a dessert food. Noodle kugel is like that too. You guys probably don't even know what that is, but like,
no.
But you know, but in the Jewish, the realm of Jewish foods, it falls into that category as well. It's basically like a sugary, like noodle-based dessert. So, in general, carrot cake, of course, is like the most egregious offender in that category.
I would agree with that because, I mean, at least pumpkins, they're not like full-on savory. Like they're still more in the sweet family, and I would say that's certainly true, obviously, of sweet potatoes. Carrots, them in sweet is incompatible to me, so I will not eat carrot cake.
Yeah, I mean, at any time you can take something that's basically inedible as a raw food and put it into a pie, you have to do it.
But Nate's really not going to like my list. So in the number 5 spot.
Wait, I had a question for Nate first. Nate, it's Thanksgiving at the Duncan household. What are you having for dessert?
You know what? I'm so locked in on some of my favorites that I don't even really have much. You know, there'll be some pumpkin pie. Usually my uncle, who like can't cook at all, he and his wife like can't really cook at all. So they'll like go to like Baker's Square, which is, you know, a pretty like mediocre pie place, and like bring over a bunch of pies. So that'll usually be the dessert here. But I'm just not focused on dessert at Thanksgiving time. The rest of the food is just too good. The opportunity cost is just too high.
I can respect that. All right, in my number 5 spot, I had rolls, which I think are – I know that you're going to be upset, Tristan, but I think they're an important part of a quality Thanksgiving meal, but I think they're more something that complements the best parts of a Thanksgiving meal rather than being the best part themselves.
Is that the rolls that are kind of like they – get served in like, you know, like a 9-pack, like they're all kind of stuck together, and they're like yellow for some reason that you don't really understand, and and like they're served with a bunch of butter. I don't mind those rolls.
Yeah, but
I just wanted to make sure we know what we're talking about here. Yeah.
They're not stuck together, the ones we've had, at least.
Okay, Nate, what's your number 4?
I would probably go with I'm really torn here. I think I'd go with cranberry sauce, but this is a vestige of my youth. There's still a few of those floating around. It's got to just be the incredibly crappy canned cranberry sauce with, like, you take it out of the can and you still see the ridges from the can on the side of it as it's put into the bowl. And then also, you know, this is a quick aside here, but when people scoop out from that cranberry sauce and, like, really, like, take away the can shape, like, if they, like, they don't, like, I realize you're using a spoon, but if you're not at least sort of, like, taking from both sides so it, like, continues to be in, like, the cylindrical shape until the end, you know, if they're just taking, like, you know, a quadrant out of it, that always kind of bothered me a little bit.
It's like stepping on snow for the first time. Like, the first snow. Yeah, that's the first
exactly,
slice
that's right.
out of cranberry sauce.
Except no imitations for the canned cranberry sauce.
Yeah, can we just end fancy cranberry sauce? I mean, it begins and ends with the can in the shape of a can.
You know, I wouldn't mind the idea of, like, a little better tasting cranberry sauce with a little more texture, but the whole berries in there, especially because, like, it always seems like they don't get the stems off the berries, and there's, like, you'll get, like, stems in this fancier cranberry sauce. And not a-
Okay, Tristan, you're number four.
For number four, I mean, to me, this might be a bit of a wild card, but I'm going mashed potatoes.
That is not a wild card. Because mashed potatoes is also my number four Thanksgiving food.
Okay, I thought maybe it would be higher. But to me, mashed potatoes are just a vessel for my number one item, which you can guess what it is.
Which is funny because, by the way, you had mashed potatoes number two the last time we did this.
Did I? Yeah. Wow. I've been, these last few years have been rough for me and mashed potatoes. But
mashed potatoes, just outside my top five.
Honorable mention.
Yeah.
Okay, so mashed potatoes, we can all agree, have been going down in the last few years. People are out on mashed potatoes.
There's just not that much going on there.
Yeah, I want the butteriest, fluffiest mashed potatoes possible. If it's basically just regular potatoes, but they happen to be mashed, almost completely inedible at that point.
A quick aside, by the way, my father, who came to great fame the last time we did a food-related podcast, is the man who salted his fast food McDonald's hamburgers. The Hungry Man, like, mashed potato flakes, dehydrated flakes that were then mixed with, like, milk and butter, those were a staple of our childhood as well for Phil Duncan.
I don't think we ever did that. We just did probably the, you know, the frozen mashed potatoes that came with the Salisbury steak and that sort of thing.
Salisbury steak, man. We never got subjected to that.
All right. Well, we shouldn't spoil a forthcoming pod. We hope to do one down the road on frozen foods.
Those mashed potatoes have defined what I look for in mashed potatoes, though. Like, frozen mashed potatoes in a little plastic tray has defined what I want in mashed potatoes for the rest of my life.
That sounds horrible.
Okay. Your number four is mashed potatoes?
Yes. I have nothing further to add here, I guess. Nate, your number three?
I would go with stuffing. And, you know, it's got to be there. I have a few stipulations, obviously. Like, there can be some bad stuffing out there.
Yes.
Like, I want it to be crispy to the extent that that's possible. Obviously, having some turkey drippings on it as well is excellent. Getting some sausage in there, especially when it's, like, really well intermingled with the rest of the stuffing. You can't have just, like, these big balls of sausage and then, you know, not good enough sausage distribution. And then too much celery, I think, has been the bane of many a stuffing.
I was going to say, stuffing doesn't reach my top five, but if I see a single piece of celery in that stuffing, I'm not eating it.
I'm with you on this. And even onions, I like onions in some context, but I do not want the crunch in my stuffing. I want it to be, unless it's the crunch of the baked, like, top of the stuffing, that's the only crunch I want.
Precisely.
Yeah, but it has to be, like, one big mealy mess. You don't want to really be able to differentiate exactly what you're eating. So I agree with you about the sausage.
Yeah, yeah. All right, your number three, Tristan.
My number three is kind of the main course. And that's turkey, and specifically dark meat turkey. White meat is fine. It's totally fine turkey. But the dark meat turkey is always the winner.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So turkey is only number three for you, huh?
Yeah. I mean, again, so much of it is just a vessel for my number one item, which kind of pulls the whole meal together. But the turkey, the white meat turkey, can be good. I feel like white meat turkey has a much higher variance, where if you can get a really good piece of white meat turkey, it probably exceeds the best dark meat turkey. But dark meat is always good, solid in every single situation. But that white meat, when it's dry, is no good.
To me, well, first off, you've just explained that white meat in turkey, it's the volume shooter of the Thanksgiving meal. It's probably taking a lot of shots. It's probably too many shots because there are more misses than there are hits.
Yeah, I mean, well, so what's your Thanksgiving ritual? Do you guys go to like a different place every year? Is it like, you know, certain aspects of the family will like host each year? Because for me, it's like Wednesday, my sister does her Friendsgiving. She's like unbelievable. She invites like, you know, 40 people over for Wednesday night because she like works in the service industry and she usually is working on actual Thanksgiving. And then my stepfather, who like absolutely kills it then with like actual Thanksgiving. So I refuse to go to any Thanksgiving that's not those two because I know that they're turkey and their number one item, which God, we're really building the suspense for what this number one item is. No one could possibly guess what it would be, are impeccable in both cases.
It's always been our aunt and uncle for a long period of time have hosted our family at Thanksgiving. And I don't want to disparage the turkey that our uncle is cooking. It's a good turkey, but it's just, I think, an inherent limitation to the form.
But what is Phil Duncan doing on Thanksgiving?
He's going to be going to my sister's Friendsgiving. And then I think he's doing something with my stepsister
He's got some mashed potato flakes.
Yeah, no, it's funny though, like, I mean, because like my sister and I are just like these massive foodies now. I mean, she's like, for real, she actually like works in the industry, like she's like a level beyond me on both appreciating food and drink. You know, I'm more of like a master of the plebeian foods, as we've discussed on previous podcasts. But you know, he just like, he'll go to these things with us, but he just doesn't like appreciate it as much. Like, food is just like not as important to him, I think, as, you know, it is for some of us, some others of us in the family.
Do you feel like, this is a major aside, but do you feel like that's a generational thing? Because for us, like the young people in our family, all we care about is eating the best possible food. And it feels like the older generation, the like baby boom generation, just wants to eat large quantities for as cheap as possible.
Yeah, maybe. Although, I mean, like my stepfather is certainly like quite the gourmet, or the gourmand. I don't know what the difference between a gourmet and a gourmand is. But I think it's fair. They're definitely, for our age and certainly the people that we hang out with, you know, nearly everyone that I know is like very interested in discussing food, whereas, you know, it's much more hit or miss in the older generation.
Yeah, it would be weird to me if I had a friend who wasn't that interested in discussing food.
Yeah, because then you'd have to talk to them about basketball, and if they weren't interested in basketball, then you'd have nothing to discuss with them at all.
The conversation would be over at that point. maybe football, if we're stretching. Yeah. All right, my number three here was sweet potato pie, which somehow did not make my list 4 years ago when we did this. Apparently, I had not eaten sufficient sweet potato pie at this point. But my aside here is that it turns out that the best sweet potato pie is actually now being made by McDonald's. Tristan, I thought you were going to jump in to back me up here, yeah, because you also have had...
You know, first off, they have pumpkin
pies. Oh, that's pumpkin pies?
That's not sweet potato pie.
Oh.
Yes. Second off, you did not see...
Imagine not being able to tell what an ingredient was at McDonald's.
The distinct flavor balance.
You're going to have to edit that out completely. Just that was never spoken. Me and Nate will never relay that to anybody else.
No, I think I'm leaving it in. I think it's good. The best pies.
I have nothing to add there.
But no, sweet potato pie over pumpkin pie is a solid favorite there in that matchup. I know I'm alone here.
Okay. No, I don't think you're wrong about that. I think sweet potato pie is kind of like maybe like a hipster pie. I feel like sweet potato pie is one of the coolest pies there are right now.
I usually hate having hipster food takes.
Pumpkin pie is the older generation's pie.
I've already made my derisive opinion known on those foods, so I'll just take it to my number two, I guess. That would be the turkey. I'm more of a white meat person, again, just because the people who cook my white meat turkey do an impeccable job. It's always awesome, to the point where it's even awesome as leftovers as well. I mean, that's one of the bigger reasons that I like it. I think it as like a sandwich, especially like if you take like a little like a French bread, put some turkey on there, and then you just slather it in our as yet unnamed number one Thanksgiving food is really outstanding. So turkey, I mean, that probably turkey plus number one, I would say, encompasses 75% of my consumption at Thanksgiving.
Interesting.
Wow.
All right, Tristan, you're number two.
For number two, I went with biscuit/rolls, basically the bread that you're making your Thanksgiving sandwich out of. Because the number one way to eat Thanksgiving dinner is to take all of it and put it into a sandwich. Every single item that you have there. Today I had that same thing, except with a burger patty on there too.
And cranberry.
Every single thing you're having at Thanksgiving, and you smash it all together as high as possible, and you make that into a sandwich. And the roll is, you know, it's holding it all together. If you have a soft, fluffy, buttery roll, it can make that the best meal that you're having all year.
Yeah, I mean, I guess this is more of like the biscuit to me is the more of the role player in this equation. So that's what, or I'm sorry, the role. Yeah, the role is the role player. Oh, I didn't even put that together until now. So I don't have it rated quite as highly, even though I agree it's an important part of a winning team. My number two.
What is your number two then?
Since I'm the only person to mention these at all, sweet potatoes, and more specifically, a gif of Vernon Davis saying sweet potato candy yams is actually my number two. I mean, I like eating sweet potatoes on their own. My typical fall like side dish will be to just do a baked sweet potato and eat that, since it's pretty simple and pretty tasty. And when you then add marshmallows and brown sugar on top of that, I mean, it's delicious. That could be the dessert. I would be fine with that.
Should we talk about gravy now?
Yeah, let's get to it. We've been waiting this whole time. The consensus, number one.
Yeah, it's my stepfather, he makes like double the amount of gravy just for me. Like I would say that my plate, there's no like, first of all, like whatever plate I'm using has to have like some sort of an edge. We used to have these great like brown plates that had almost like an inch edge on the side, and that edge was all the way like over at the edge. It wasn't like, okay, there's like a middle portion and then there's an edge on that, and then there's this superfluous like edge to the plate that's decorative but doesn't actually like have any room for your food. Now these plates were amazing. We've kind of gone away from that in recent years, but nonetheless, like I have every inch of my plate that isn't covered by a food item is covered with gravy. And I get so much gravy in each bite. I make sure that each bite of turkey is completely soaked in gravy. Each bite of mashed potatoes is, each bite of stuffing often as well, that even so with that much gravy, there's no gravy left on the plate by the time I have finished that plate. It is my absolute favorite. But the caveat is you got to have great gravy, because bad gravy can just ruin your entire Thanksgiving. And that of course is why I'm so fastidious about where I have my Thanksgiving.
That's true. Justin, do you?
Easily number one. I mean, not even a competitor to gravy on the Thanksgiving meal. I mean, basically, gravy is number one, two, three, four, and five, especially because when you're making the gravy out of the drippings from the turkey, which is how gravy should be made, you have so much turkey in there already. It's like when I'm making gravy from those drippings, I'll pull off a bunch of little pieces from the turkey, the moistest pieces, mix them all around so that if you wanted to, you could scoop some mashed potatoes, do the little hole in the middle with the gravy, and that could even be your turkey. You don't need large pieces of turkey. You can have it floating around in your gravy, and it is excellent.
Like, have you, I remember there was one time, this is my previous girl that I dated. This is really probably the beginning of the end of our relationship. Like, we were at her place. They went for like a deep fried turkey. Actually, what they did was they let's buy the deep fryer, like cook the turkey in it, and then like try to return it afterwards.
Oh my God.
and so like her grandmother didn't really like speak much English. And so she would just like kind of do stuff, and there was just like there was like no way to stop her. You know, like at one point, apparently she just like hid like $5,000 in cash like somewhere in the house, and like no one knew where it was, and they just like never found it again. But in any event, we were like all set to like make the turkey gravy out of like, you know, the turkey neck and the gizzard and all that. And then like all of a sudden it disappeared. And then like it came out. We were like, what are we going to do? We have to like make turkey, like make gravy with like no turkey. Like the turkey is in the deep fryer. So like you can't really make it out of the turkey when it's being deep fried. You have to like take out part of the turkey to make the gravy. And then like it came out as like some soup later that like her grandmother had just made, and like no one knew what she was doing. And it was not a holly jolly Thanksgiving that year.
Wow. She ruined Thanksgiving. Oh, man. I'm assuming, Kevin, this is your number one also. Have you confirmed this?
It is my number one also. Yeah, it's the consensus number one for sure. I mean, yeah, gravy is the key reason why Thanksgiving is such a good food holiday, because in no other situation is gravy as prominently featured as on Thanksgiving.
Do we definitely – so I was talking with my coworkers about this, our top five Thanksgiving items, and I was like, clearly gravy is number one. But one of them argued that gravy shouldn't even count as an item because you're having all of the other things with gravy. It's not like you eat gravy completely on its own, although you could.
Only decorum prevents us from doing so.
But do we feel like it definitely counts as its own Thanksgiving food item?
Yeah, why not? It's like the defining thing that has it. I mean, like what else? Like without it, the meal would be nothing.
I mean, I guess you could say like mashed potatoes with gravy would be like a higher one. But yeah, I still think you got to count it separately, because if theoretically it were removed, everything else would fall apart.
This podcast is getting way too pedantic for me. This is just not the sort of thing I'm into. Yeah,
without gravy, there's no potatoes, there's no turkey, there's no pilgrims, there's no Charlie Brown. Thanksgiving does not exist without the gravy.
I mean, is this what this podcast is? It's just you guys like obsessing about the minutiae of food like over and over again and like categorizing things. I mean, it's just like just people gravy. Don't get bored of that. Like, you know, it's just not my thing at all. Like, I don't know why you invite me on this show.
Well, thank you so much for bearing with it. I know this has been a difficult 25 minutes for you, Dave.
It's been a struggle for you, I have to say. I mean, I couldn't even come up with anything to say, honestly. Like, you guys are just like, it's so mundane. God.
Please, don't write the iTunes reviews for people, man. Come on. All right. On that note, thanks so much for taking the time, Nate. Thanks for listening, and a happy Thanksgiving to everyone.